as all of you probably know, our featured, our honored speaker for today is Benjamin Friedman. He's the William Joseph Meyer Professor of Political Economy at Harvard University. He is director of the Private Export Funding Corporation, trustee of the Standish Mellon Investment Trust, director of the National Council on Economic Education, advisor to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and so on and so forth. He is, as all of us no doubt know, immensely influential in his scholarship. Perhaps most obviously, his well-known book, Day of Reckoning. More recently, he's written The Moral Consequences of Economic Growth, which has been widely heralded as a landmark contribution, one that in effect lays out the positive social externalities of economic growth. And he's contributed widely more generally to issues of economic policy, and in particular the role of financial markets in shaping how fiscal policies affect economic activity. And then many of you might also be quite familiar with his frequent contributions to the New York Review of Books. Today he's giving a talk titled Inequality and Attitudes Toward Inequality, and I have to confess to being more than eager to hear it, so I think we should just get to it. Welcome.
Thank you, David, and thank you very much for inviting me, and thank you for your hospitality and arranging such an enjoyable and interesting day. I'm delighted to be here and very honored to be participating. When you were rattling off the various activities that I actually do participate in, one that I realized you probably don't know about, but I'll mention it, is that I happen to be a director of the Merriam-Webster Dictionary Company. And the reason this is relevant is that I've always wanted to be able to do something that my late colleague Ken Galbraith reveled in. Ken, as you may know, was a director of the American Heritage Dictionary. And Ken would always relate with great relish an experience in which he was testifying before some congressional committee. And at the end of his remarks, some young congressman, knowing Ken, I'm guessing it must have been a Republican, apparently criticized him for misusing a word in his prepared remarks. And according to Ken, he addressed the young man and said, "Young man, I'll have you know I'm a director of the American Heritage Dictionary. And if my usage of the word is inconsistent with the dictionary, I shall have the dictionary changed accordingly." And so I've always wanted to have the experience of doing that. And so I'm waiting for someone to tell me that my use of the word inequality doesn't conform to the way in which people normally use that word. What I'd like to do this afternoon in these remarks is first remind ourselves of the basic dimensions of widening inequality in the United States. I think everybody understands that inequality is widening very dramatically in this country. That's why we're here, presumably, having this seminar. I'd like to say something about the causes of that widening inequality, but my real agenda is to think about how widening inequality affects our attitudes toward a variety of matters that are of interest to the democratic polity, and then to think through how these changes in attitudes are in turn likely to affect not only the country we live in, more generally, but our economy. The place to begin is by quantifying the increase in inequality that we have been experiencing. The standard measure, which is one that I'll use as well, is the Gini coefficient. Without going into technical detail, the Gini coefficient is a number that would be zero if inequality were perfect, and it would be unity if one individual owned all of the wealth or had all of the income in the society. The practical range among developed industrialized country for variation of the Gini coefficient is approximately 30 to 35 points. So a Scandinavian country today would have a Gini coefficient value in the mid-20s, and a developed Latin American country like Brazil or Argentina would be something approaching 60. So in a world in which the practical range of variation is 35 points, since the late 1960s, the Gini coefficient in the United States has widened by 10 points. If we go back to the late 60s, our Gini coefficient was about 35. That's, again, compared to a Scandinavian country in the mid-20s. Today, our Gini coefficient is close to 45. So it's an increase of 10 on a scale in which the entire range of variation is only 35. So that's a lot. And we see what's happening by looking across the income distribution. It turns out that all parts of the income distribution are losing share in the United States compared to the people at the top. If we look at the fraction of the country's total income that's going to people in the bottom one-fifth of the distribution, that was 4.5% of the total income in the United States at the end of World War II. Doesn't sound like a lot, it wasn't a lot, but it's lower today. Between the end of World War II and the early 1970s, the fraction of income going to the lowest fifth of the population went from 4.5% to about 5.75%. Doesn't sound like a lot, but that's a 25% increase in the fraction of the income that the lowest fifth of the population were getting. Today, it's not only not 5.75%, it's not 4.5% either, it's down to 4%. So the lowest fifth of our population is getting distinctly less, about 10% less of the national income than they were at the end of World War II. The second from the bottom fifth of the population in the mid-50s was getting close to 13% of the national income. Today they're getting about 9.5%, so that's an erosion of about a quarter in their share. The middle fifth of the income distribution in the mid-50s was getting 18% of the national income. Today they're getting 15%, so that's in loss of about a sixth of their share. So one can ask, well, where is all this money going? Where is the income going if it isn't going to the bottom fifth, the next fifth, the next fifth, and it isn't going to the next fifth either? The answer is it's going to the top fifth. Back in the mid-1960s, the top fifth of the income distribution was getting 40% of the national income. Today, it's nearly half. So the very dramatic increase. And within that top fifth, it's primarily the top 5%. Within the top 5%, it's almost entirely within the top 1%. And within the top 1%, it's very heavily within the top half of 1%. So the increase is, as the geometricians would say, fractile. The higher up the scale you go, income inequality is steadily widening. The second fact that's going to be important for the remarks I want to make is that while property income matters for this purpose, by property income I mean primarily interest and dividends and also capital gains, overwhelmingly what has been happening has reflected widening inequality in labor income, that is to say, in wages. The wage rates for people in the top of the income distribution have been widening dramatically in the last 25 years. There's been more than a 30% widening of the wage rate for people in the top 10% of the distribution compared to people in the middle of the wage distribution. And furthermore, these widening differentials for wage rates have been reinforced by changes in the benefits that people have received, by changes in the workplace amenities that people have received, and moreover, by changes in hours worked. Even among Americans who are classified as working full-time, the work week has gotten longer for people at the top of the wage scale and either shorter or remain the same for people in the middle and the bottom. And as a result, this 30% widening of the differential between people in the top 10% of the distribution and people at the middle among wage earners is less than the increase, the widening in wage income, because people at the top are now working more hours. And the final fact that I will mention is that people in other countries have been, other advanced industrialized countries, have been experiencing a similar widening, albeit to a lesser extent. Now, all of this has come as a big shock to economists. 50 years ago, my one-time Harvard colleague Simon Kuznets enunciated a widely understood, widely publicized hypothesis to the extent that in the early phases of economic development, as a country would become richer, income inequality would widen for a while, emphasis for a while, and then inequality would turn around and start to go back down. And once it went back down, it would not come back up again. This is widely known as the Kuznets hypothesis, reinforced by further work, for example, my colleague Jeff Williamson. As of 1955, when Simon Kuznets enunciated this idea, it was consistent with the facts, not only in developing countries, which that were then on the way up, but also in countries like the United States, the UK, and others that were on the way down. Alas, it turns out that Kuznets was extrapolating a development which looked as if it were firmly in place when he was alive, but by the late 60s and certainly by the 1970s, this had turned around. And so what we have is a contradiction of the Kuznets hypothesis, which was widely understood and accepted in its day. Now, why is inequality widening so much? The answers are many, but the principal answer is something to do with skill and experience. The important thing to realize is that inequality, both here and abroad, is not widening at random. Inequality is widening systematically, and the systematic component is operative across any measure that has something to do with skill, experience, education. So, for example, the premium in the wage that college-educated workers earn in the United States compared to workers with only a high school education is now exactly double what it was at the turn, double what it was in the middle of the 19th century. In the middle of the 20th century. In 1950, college-educated workers, on average, earned 31% more than workers with a high school education. As recently as 1980, the college over high school wage premium was still only 38%, up but not up very much. Today it's 62%, exactly double what it was in 1950. Now, between the early 20th century and 1950, the college wage premium had been going down. So we have now undone a half a century's worth of decline from the beginning of the 20th century to 1950, and we're now back to where we were before World War I. Similarly, the wage premium by which high school educated workers earn more than workers who don't even have a high school education has been widening, but not nearly so much. Today, the premium of what high school educated workers earn over dropouts is about 30% compared to in the low 20s% in 1950. So the key widening has been at the top end of the high school of the education distribution, in the same way that the key widening of differentials in wages has been in the upper half of the distribution. It's the difference between what people in the top tenth make compared to people in the middle, much more so than the widening between what people in the middle make compared to people at the bottom. And similarly, if we look at education, it's much more the widening of the college over high school premium rather than the high school over dropout premium. Now, why has all this occurred? It's important to have some notion of what the causes are underlying this widening of inequality. Economists and others have pointed to a wide variety of causes. And no doubt each cause has its particular adherents, but I think it's fair to say that there is a broad consensus, at least among economists, that one explanation is in first place, one is in second place, and everything else is an also-ran in this game. The explanation that is overwhelmingly in first place is the one that's immediately suggested by the fact that the widening of inequality is taking place across these dimensions related to skill, education, experience. That is that technological change in our economy is running ahead of our ability to supply workers with the skills that are needed. The right way to think about the widening of education premia in the labor market is not just the technological change itself, which increases the demand for certain kinds of skills in the labor force. It's as the race between what's happening on the demand side of the market and what's happening on the skill side of the market. Arguably, the increase in the demand for certain kinds of skills in the labor market has been ongoing, with some periods of acceleration and some periods of deceleration, pretty much throughout the last 100 years. What's different in the last 25 years is the slowdown in the rate at which our education system is supplying workers with the skills that are being demanded. Now, this doesn't mean that our education system isn't supplying more of those workers. The fraction of the American labor force that has a college education is approximately 4 times now what it was in the 1950s. It's approximately 32% of all American workers today, full-time workers have college degrees compared to only about 8% in the middle of the 20th century. So to be clear, the argument is not that we have stopped increasing the supply of skilled workers relative to the supply of unskilled workers. It's rather that the rate at which we are doing so is lagging behind the ongoing increase in the demand for skilled workers relative to the demand for unskilled workers. And largely this has to do with a slowdown in the growth of the rise of educational attainment of successive U.S.-born cohorts of workers. There was a period in which the fraction of our young people who were graduating from high school was rapidly rising. The high school graduation rate has not changed in the last 20, 25 years. It's remained at about 89% of our young people now graduate from high school. The fraction of the high school graduates who go on to college was, for a while, rising rapidly. It isn't rising rapidly anymore. So we have an ongoing increase in the supply of skilled relative to unskilled labor, but that ongoing increase is slowing down while there's no slowdown and maybe even a pickup in the rate at which the demand for skilled as opposed to unskilled labor is increasing. So skill-biased technical change, as economists call it, is overwhelmingly in first place. What about the other explanations? The second one has to do with a corresponding skill bias in those who come to the United States. My colleague George Borjas at the Kennedy School at Harvard has worked intensively on the question of how the mix of immigrants coming into the United States, not the total number, but the mix of immigrants, has affected inequality. And Borjas's conclusion is that because the mix of immigrants is skewed toward low-skill immigrants, even among legal immigrants, and we have to assume that illegal immigrants are much more likely even to be unskilled. Today, low-end wages in our distribution are somewhere between 7% and 9% lower than they would otherwise be if the skill mix of the immigrants matched the skill mix of American workers. So that's the explanation that's in second place. What are some of the others? Other familiar explanations are things like changes in corporate compensation requirements or practices, a topic to which I will return. The eroding value of the real minimum wage. As most people, I assume, are aware, recently the minimum wage was changed, moved upward for the first time in 10 years. As of last year, before the change took place, the minimum wage had been $5.15 an hour for about 10 years, and this meant, among other things, that the minimum wage as of the end of 2006 was a third below what it had been in the late 1960s in real terms. So the minimum wage is only now about back in real terms, meaning inflation-adjusted terms, is only now about back to where it was when under Eisenhower we first had a minimum wage of $1 an hour. So the eroding value of the minimum wage is on the list. The vanishing role of labor unions, especially in the private sector of our economy, is important in this regard as well. I assume my colleague Richard Freeman would have talked about this, but today only 7 out of 100 workers in America's private sector belong to labor unions. And even including the government sector, only 12 workers out of 100 in America belong to labor unions. Far, far down compared to what it was a half a century ago. So we have no absence, no lack of explanations, but to repeat, far and away the one that's in first place in the estimation of most economists is the one having to do with skill bias in technological change compared to the skills increase in the supply side of the labor market. Now, the fact that we think this policy or this explanation is the most important one on the list has very important policy implications, both for the implication for education, which is obvious if the problem is that the supply of skills isn't keeping up with the demand for skills. That says something about the education requirements that are should be placed on our economy. But also there are important self-correcting dynamics associated with this problem, because the wider the wage premium gets, of course, the more incentives workers have, or young people have as well, to get education, to get training. And similarly, the more incentive businesses have to find ways to economize on high-skilled labor. So if you ask, what, for example, is a way in which a business can economize on high-skilled labor, think about what happened after businesses, say in the retail fast food market, first started to use smart cash registers. Well, it took a lot of skill to be able to program in these smart cash registers, so they decided to innovate with cash registers that were smart enough that they didn't require smart people to operate them. Namely, the keys have pictures of the items that are being bought instead of having to type in code. So there turns out there are lots of ways to do it. Now, against this factual background, I want to address the issue of how widening inequality affects our attitudes and affects our polity more generally. The first question I want to ask is whether inequality might directly affect our sense of social and economic well-being. Well, it certainly could, because our sense of what we want from our society could depend in a direct way on distributions, and it could depend in a direct way not just on equality of opportunities, but on our perception of equality of outcomes. Almost 40 years ago, Lester Thoreau first hypothesized in a very specific way that people might have direct preferences over the distribution of incomes, seeing income distribution as a kind of public good in the society. And more recently, the idea has again caught on with people like Ernst Fehr, Klaus Schmidt, and others who have written about this. Second, we have some limited direct evidence that whether individuals are satisfied with their lives has something to do with the degree of inequality in the society in which they live. Now, the evidence is rather subtle. If we simply look at the raw correlation between country averages of what people report for their self-reported happiness of their lives, or subjective well-being, as the psychologists would call it, the raw correlation of countrywide averages for self-reported happiness versus the inequality in the country, we find there's no correlation whatsoever. So just to take a few examples, countries with the highest levels of self-reported happiness on average for the population of the country would include Denmark, with a Gini coefficient of only 25, again compared to us at 45, would include Ireland, with a Gini coefficient of 34. So distinct, these are very equal societies. By contrast, Brazil, with a Gini coefficient of 58, and Colombia, with a Gini of 59, also have very high average levels of self-reported happiness. So the raw correlation is absolutely zero. If, however, we also control for the level of income in the country, in other words, we run a regression with countrywide average happiness on the left, and on the right, not only the Gini measure, but also the per capita income in the country, then we discover, interestingly, that the correlation is positive. In other words, in countries where the inequality is wider after controlling for income, people are happier. So one possibility is that inequality makes people happier. Now, if we turn to the individual survey evidence, it becomes very complicated. If we, for example, use state-by-state data within the United States so that we look at the individual answers to the how happy are you question among Americans, and we know all of the usual determinants that are personal about people, like their income, like their age, like whether they're married, like whether they're black, white, Asian, so forth, what we discover is that in the United States, there are groups of people who are more unhappy, apparently because they live in states where income is less equal. Now, is this the entire population? No. It turns out that there's one identifiable group of people in the United States who exhibit this negative reaction to living in a state that's more widely unequal, and it turns out to be the rich. It's not the poor in the United States, it's the rich who are made unhappy by being in a state that's unequal. Now, if we can do the same thing in Europe by looking at the individual responses to the how happy are you question, and then looking at the country by country pattern of inequality. And in Europe, again, it's not the entire population that's made unhappy by being in a country that has a lot of inequality. In Europe, it's the poor. So we have this odd pattern in which in the United States, it's the rich who are made unhappy by inequality. In Europe, it's the poor. Now, pressing further, and now we're getting closer to our subject of how inequality affects attitudes, it seems pretty clear that all this would have something to do with perceptions of why inequality matters. And so here we get into various aspects of who thinks what about where inequality comes from. For example, if asked, what do you think is the leading cause of people's economic success or failure, 54% of Europeans answer luck. Now, they don't specify whether it's luck that happens to you personally or luck in the sense that you were born to rich parents, but they answer luck. Only 30% believe that luck, only 30% of Americans believe that luck is important. So where one thinks inequality comes from in the first place matters. Conversely, if you ask people the question, why are the poor poor? Is it society's fault or is it that they're lazy? The answer that the poor are lazy, is given by only 26% of Europeans, but given by 60% of Americans. And further, if we ask the question, and I'm going to come to issues of mobility in the moment, if you ask whether people think the poor are trapped in their poverty, 60% of Europeans answer yes, 29% of Americans answer yes. So what people think about the sources of economic success or failure and what people think about the permanence of economic success or failure is extremely important. Now, I would argue that mobility and perceptions of mobility are particularly important in the United States. To go back quite a long way, Tocqueville, for example, thought that there was no such thing as immobility in the United States. Tocqueville famously said, and here I'm quoting, "To tell the truth, though there are rich men, the class of rich men does not exist. The rich are constantly becoming poor." This is Tocqueville, remember, visiting the United States in the early 1830s. Remember, he was here at a period when Andrew Jackson was the president, very important. Jackson was the first American president not from the Eastern Seaboard, the first American president not to have any formal education, the first American president not to have English ancestry. And so you can see why Tocqueville, arriving during Jackson's presidency, would have had the view that he did. Now, coming forward a bit, I assume this is a university where one does not have to go into great detail about Lipset's ideas, but in the book with Reinhard Bendix, Lipset posed the paradox that although there was a widespread belief, again this is 1959, that mobility is greater in the United States than in other industrialized democracy, Lipset and Bendix argued that there was no evidence that this was true. The Lipset finding was that European countries were more stratified in terms of social class than the United States, but they were not more extreme in their immobility. And then the bulk of the Lipset-Bendix argument consisted of a series of reasons to explain the paradox that everybody thought the United States was more socioeconomically mobile, even though it turned out there was no evidence that there was so. Coming through, following the Lipset Bendix book, there was a widespread interest among economists in measuring mobility. And I would say for about a quarter of a century after the Lipset Bendix work, most economists who worked on the problem came up with answers that led one to believe that intergenerational mobility was quite large in the United States. Or to say it the other way around, the continuity from one generation to the next in earnings levels, income levels within families was pretty small. So in the mid-1980s, Gary Becker surveyed a wide variety, as I recall, about two dozen papers that had examined intergenerational mobility versus continuity, and Becker found that the correlation not the correlation, the size of the continuity from one generation to the next, in most of these papers was measured in the range of about 0.15 to 0.20. What that would mean is that if my father had $100,000 of income over the nationwide median in his generation, I would, in expectation, have only $15,000 to $20,000 of income over the median in my generation. So the continuity coefficient, as estimated in this work that took place mostly between the Lipset-Bendix book and the mid-80s, found a continuity coefficient of only about 15 to 20. More recent work in the field, however, I have in mind people like Gary Solon, David Zimmerman, has argued that there were statistical biases in this earlier work that Becker surveyed. I can go into detail, but I'll skip it. And the Solon and Zimmerman argument is that a much better estimate would be an intergenerational continuity coefficient in the range of 0.4 to 0.45. The most recent generation of work, I have in mind Bashgar Mazumdar, has now argued that the intergenerational coefficient in the United States is now up at about 0.55 to 0.60. Now, whether this represents actual declining mobility to go along with the widening inequality, or whether this is, as Solon and Zimmerman argue, simply getting better estimates of what was there all the time, remains a very open question among economists. But it's worth pointing out that there are reasons to suspect that the mobility is indeed eroding. And the reason has to do precisely with these skills in the labor market. Heckman, for example, Jim Heckman and others have argued that the kinds of skills that people acquire very early on, even in preschool periods, are very important for the perpetuation of learning throughout the education experience, so that instead of people coming into education at age 5 with differentials that they maintain, the Heckman finding is that skill differentials and competency and differentials widen steadily and dramatically. And so to the extent that one thinks that some of these educational differentials have to do with the kind of preparedness for the educational experience that people get from their family setting, you can easily at least tell a coherent story about why mobility might be eroding in a world in which the inequality in the labor force is importantly centered around education. Now, in the work that I've been doing in the last some years, the main focus of my work has been not on inequality but growth. But I think there's an important way, especially for the United States, in which the two come together in a way that's very, very undesirable. And I'd like to spell out what the growth hypothesis is and then explain how widening inequality on a scale of what we're now experiencing in this country has the ability to undermine the kind of effects that my earlier argument predicts from economic growth. The basic hypothesis that I've developed in recent work is that when the broad bulk of the population has a sense of getting ahead economically, by which I mean that people sense that they're living better than they and their families have in the past, and they have some optimism that this improvement in material living standards is likely to continue into the future, and even some ground for confidence that this will continue on to their children after them. This is a condition, and perhaps the important condition, under which people are likely in their attitudes and in the public policies that they support to think and act in ways that Western thinking for at least the last 200 years has taken to be not just positive, but positive in explicitly moral terms. I have in mind things like the provision of opportunities, tolerance, fairness with what? Fairness with respect to not just opportunities, but how we treat the disadvantaged in our societies. I have in mind things like the strength of our commitment to democracy. To illustrate in just one policy issue I have in mind, let me take the one that is the most obvious contentious issue in the election campaign that we're currently in, namely the most obvious domestic policy issue, namely attitudes toward immigrants. Ask yourself the following questions. Why did the United States have a wave of anti-immigrant violence in the 1850s? Why did it go away, which it did, after the Civil War? Why did we have the return in the 1880s and 1890s, not of violence, but of really very ugly anti-immigrant agitation? Why did that give way after the turn of the 20th century to widespread attitude of welcoming, or to use the vocabulary of the day, Americanizing very large numbers of immigrants? As my colleague Claudia Golden has shown, this is the origin of the high school movement in the United States. If the national program was going to be to Americanize large numbers of immigrants, there had to be some vehicle, some mechanism for doing that, and the chosen mechanism was a high school education, and not just with the old-fashioned so-called Latin curriculum, but as they called it, the English curriculum. Why did all this give way in the 1920s to the most numerically restrictive, but also most discriminatory immigration legislation in our country's history? I refer to the 1921 Quota Act, and even more so the opprobriously named, but appropriately named, National Origins Act of 1924, coming forward with the story, why was all that discrimination thrown out in the 1960s? We had a widespread liberalization of economic, of immigration. Why did we then, in the late 70s and on into the early 80s, start to get pushback against immigration? Proposition 187 here in California, movements in other high immigration states like Texas and Florida to deny various forms of legal of benefits to immigrants. Why did that all go away in the 1990s so that when we got to the year 2000, the one candidate who chose to run for president on an explicitly anti-immigrant platform, namely Pat Buchanan, got so few votes even in the Republican primaries that he had to change parties? And why is it that here we are the better part of a decade later and we are back in the mess again? Now, it would be foolish to pretend, and I don't, that every twist and turn in this 150-year experience of American attitudes toward immigrants was narrowly or deterministically driven by the underlying ebb and flow of prosperity and stagnation. But I argue with some vigor in my recent book that it would be even more foolish to look at the evidence and come away with some sense that the underlying economics had nothing to do with it. And again and again and again, whether the issue is immigrants or race relations or generosity to the poor or opening opportunities to women, even the most basic issues of who gets to vote, again and again and again, you cannot come away from looking at the evidence without a clear sense that whether the broad bulk of the population has a sense of this forward progress in its material well-being is an important part of the story. Now, why is this a sobering matter for the United States today? It is a sobering matter precisely because the broad bulk of the population isn't getting ahead in the United States. The most recent year for which we have median income data is 2006. The median family income in 2006 was $58,400. At the beginning of this decade, the median family income was $59,400 in 2006 prices. So we've had almost a 2% decline in the median income over the period since this decade. Now, is this a story about economic growth in the standard sense? No, it is not. And the reason is that our aggregate production, the gross domestic product, has increased over that period by 2.4% per annum on average. That's not great, but that is not all bad for a mature post-industrial economy like the United States. The reason for the gap between this 2.4% per annum growth in the aggregate production and the actual decline in real family incomes for the majority of the population is also not that our population is increasing so rapidly. That's only about 1% of the difference. The difference has to do with this distributional matter that we're addressing here. The United States today is an example of an economy where the growth in aggregate production is being more than fully offset by the widening inequality from the perspective of delivering a rising standard of living to the bulk of the population. And on that ground, my concern would be that for reasons that do now stem directly from the kind of work I've been doing in recent years, I would expect our commitment to things like opportunity, I would expect our tolerance, I would expect our fairness, or attitudes toward fairness, and even our commitment to democracy, and the strengthening the institutions of our democracy to be under threat from exactly this issue. Now, just to make the point that this needn't always be the case, let me take the obvious example on the other side. As people may well be aware, inequality in China is widening much more rapidly than it's widening here. 30, 40 years ago, the Chinese had an income distribution that was much more egalitarian than ours. People may not know, incomes in China are now distributed more unequally than they are in the United States. Quite a turnaround for a former communist country. But nonetheless, the income growth, the growth of aggregate production has been so rapid in China, 9% a year on average after adjusting for prices, that there's plenty of income so that even with the widening inequality, the great majority of Chinese are living better than they did 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. The great majority of Americans are not, and the only period in which the median family income in this country showed any increase to speak of over the last 30 years was the mid and late 1990s. Median incomes for families in the United States showed essentially zero growth from the early 70s to the early 90s. Then there was a period of about three quarters of a decade of very substantial growth, and now the median income thus far in this decade has actually been going down. Now, I'd like to think a moment about the consequences of this inequality which interacting with our positive but modest growth rate is delivering declining incomes to the majority of Americans. The concern I have is that we are likely to find ourselves in some kind of a vicious circle in which, for reasons that I think are clear in the work of many economists, although not me particularly, but many economists work on this, widening inequality leads to eroding economic growth. And there are many economists who work on this. My colleague Alberto Alazina, Guido Tabellini, others. And at the same time, because the widening inequality is eroding the incomes of the majority of our families, we will be less inclined to take policy steps that might help correct the inequality. And as a result, there's a possibility for there's a possibility of a kind of vicious circle of the kind that in other respects my recent book I talked a lot about the possibility of vicious or virtuous circles in the interaction between democratic political institutions and economic growth. You could be in a good equilibrium where positive economic growth fosters democracy and improving democracy fosters growth, or you could be in a bad equilibrium in the other way. Here I'm talking not about that subject about which I've written, but rather a potential vicious circle having to do with a two-way interaction between economic growth and inequality. A second way in which I think inequality matters, not just for economic growth, but for the quality of our society as a whole, has to do with interpersonal trust. We have a lot of information now on, again, survey information on the answer to whether people trust one another. We also know that higher levels of interpersonal trust are conducive to better economic growth. But my interest is not just in that, but rather in the sense that interpersonal trust is something that we might well value in and of itself. Now, not my own result, but I have a student who recently has been working on this subject and has found that there is a sharp relationship between inequality across countries and average levels of interpersonal trust across countries, and moreover, a relationship that is enough to matter economically. So, for example, consider two countries that differ both in inequality and also in trust levels. In Argentina, on the scale in principle is 1 to 100, but in fact very few countries ever get above 50. In Argentina, the level of personal trust is at 21 on this putative 1 to 100 scale. In Austria, the level of interpersonal trust is 33. So 21 versus 33 on the trust scale. But we also know that Argentina, as is true for lots of Latin American countries, is a very unequal economy, where while Austria, as is true for most continental European countries, is much more equal. In Argentina, the Gini is 52, remember, compared to us at 45, and in Austria, the Gini is 30. According to the empirical work by my student, whose name incidentally is Reggiani, the difference between the inequality in Austria and the inequality in Argentina explains half of the difference between the low level of interpersonal trust in Argentina compared to the level of interpersonal trust in Austria. Well, I find that an interesting finding, but I also find it a not very pleasing finding, because as we are, remember, the difference in inequality between Austria and Argentina is 22 points. The erosion of inequality in the United States in the last 30 years has been 10 points. So if the difference in inequality between Argentina and Austria explains half of their difference in trust, we have moved half of that distance on the inequality scale. Now, I want to take just a few minutes to, I'm skipping over lots of material here, but we can come back if people are relevant. I want to take just a few minutes now to say something about the way in which widening inequality has something to do with our notion of just desserts. In other words, what is it that people are entitled to? Well, clearly, I've touched on this before when I was talking about matters such as whether people think the poor are lazy, whether people think economic success or failure is a matter of luck versus hard work. But I want to ask questions now about the extent to which people have a just desserts entitlement to various kinds of incomes. So to begin, how about inheritances? Well, that's an easy one. Tocqueville, for example, said, and again I quote, "Among a democratic people, there is no hereditary wealth." End of story, end of quotation. We now move on, having dealt with inheritances. How about physical attributes? My colleague Greg Mankiw recently wrote a widely discussed paper on whether there should be a height tax in the United States. I don't know whether it's true here at Stanford, but a widely familiar finding is that the single variable which accounts for the largest share of the variance in the incomes among graduates of the Harvard Business School is height. Higher height leads to higher income, in case you didn't know the sign of the correlation. Now, Mankiw interestingly picked on height because it's an attribute for which people can take no credit whatsoever. If I am a very skilled baseball player, well, maybe that's some kind of inherited attribute. Maybe it's something my father taught me when I was 3 years old. But maybe I worked very hard to become a skilled baseball player. It's hard to tell the story whereby people did anything to create their own height. And so Mankiw works through a set of calculations in his paper in which he shows what the optimal tax on height would be. Now, Mankiw, being 6'2", treats this as a joke. Mankiw chooses height and works through the analysis and the empirical calculation as a kind of reductio ad absurdum. He says, you know, here's what it would look like. Isn't this ridiculous? And because it's this obvious case is so ridiculous, it must be, therefore, the situation that trying to tax other kinds of physical attributes or other kinds of intellectual attributes on the basis that people didn't work hard to achieve them is absurd. I, being only 5'8", read Mankiw's paper and didn't see what was so funny. I thought, well, you know, one could tell a reasonable story. Now, how about intellectual attributes? Here we get a little more complicated. Again, Tocqueville. Tocqueville said, quote, "Whatever efforts a people may make, the inequality of minds would still remain, which, coming directly from the hand of God," I read that to be Tocqueville's way of making a genetic argument, "will forever escape the laws of man." So we're never going to get rid of intellectual inequality. But maybe the fact that I have certain intellectual attributes reflects not just my genetic capabilities or the, as Heckman would have it, my early childhood training, but the fact that I worked very hard. But maybe the fact that I worked very hard is itself a consequence of some kinds of inherited attributes. Samuel Scheffler has an argument to the effect that liberal political, I'm really paraphrasing here, not quoting, that liberal political philosophy has essentially despaired of assigning any role to desert in accounts of distributional justice. And Scheffler's argument is that this is largely on grounds of skepticism about the possibility for this kind of human agency. Well, I think there's something very deep in this. Well, I'm an economist, and for me it's easy to think about taxing away people's rents. A rent to an economist is simply a return that's given to some factor of production, like my height, that is supplied with zero elasticity. So economists are pre-programmed to think that people are not entitled to rents. But that's too easy. What I want to ask is the hard question. Are people entitled to their marginal product? Now, all you have to do is show up for the first month of the introductory course in economics, and you get the overwhelming message that the right way to distribute rewards is by paying people their marginal product. And I want to take just a few minutes to use two examples to ask whether there is any just desert sense in which people have an entitlement in their marginal product. Example one. I'm a worker at a factory. The owner of the factory installs, at his expense, new modern machinery. With the new modern machinery in place, my marginal product as a worker at the factory is now greater. Now, we understand, of course, the allocative advantages, that is to say, the efficiency advantages of paying a higher wage to the worker at the factory with the more modern equipment. The efficiency advantage is that this is a way of drawing labor away from the older factories where the labor is less productive to the newer factories where the worker is more productive. So on efficiency grounds, so how do you allocate the labor? We understand why this is an argument. But how about justice? How about just desserts? Is there any sense in which I, as the worker at the what's now the more productive factory, have any kind of a just desserts claim to this higher wage? I would argue no. Second example, I'm a worker and plutocrat arrow in front of me is the owner of a factory that's located far up in some remote location. Through no agency of either Arrow's or mine, the California government decides to run a new modern highway so that the factory that Arrow owns and where Friedman works is no longer so remote. As a result, the cost of getting the factory's products to market goes down, and therefore the factory can be more competitive and can charge a higher price. And I've been saying that the economic principle is that people should be paid their marginal product. More refined version is that people are paid their marginal revenue product, and even though the efficiency of the factory, the marginal physical product hasn't been changed by the new road, the marginal revenue product is higher. Once again, the typical argument from efficiency is that because it's now more efficient, factory is more efficient, and get the product to market, it's better to have more factories built there. So Arrow Plutocrat, owner of the factory, is entitled or it should get a higher profit, and Friedman worker should get a higher wage, and this will attract both more capital and more labor to this location. Once again, the efficiency, the allocation of resources argument goes through, but is there any just desserts argument by which Arrow should get more profit and Friedman should get a higher wage? Seems to me the answer is no. Now, this has obvious implications not just for extreme arguments that think of Nozick type arguments that taxation is illegitimate, but I think it has a variety of implications for distribution as in a much broader sense, recognizing that the fact that efficiency is not the whole of the story, of course, does not mean that efficiency doesn't matter. And furthermore, there are two senses of efficiency involved here. There's static efficiency, and there's also dynamic efficiency, because to the extent that we've been talking about inequality associated with skills in the labor market, the time I spend to teach my children things in early childhood is a kind of investment in the future, so that my effort today is what builds tomorrow's skill set. So these are very subtle dynamic questions, but I think they are serious questions nonetheless. Let me finally just list very quickly four policy steps that I would take. And I'm happy to go, I've run over time, but I'm happy to go into detail on any of these, but I don't want to, I've already taken a few minutes away from our discussion period, and I'd like to not do that too much. Four policy steps. One, remember that even if the only reason for widening inequality were the skill bias technical change, and even remembering that there is a dynamic self-correcting mechanism triggered by that process. Nonetheless, the public education system in a country where 91% of K through 12 education is provided by the public sector is an important part of the corrective, and therefore public education is a is important. And I'm guessing there are people in the room who know more about what's wrong with our public education system than I do, but I'm happy to talk about it. Second, we should absolutely pursue policies that will simultaneously foster growth and at the same time promote mobility and equality of both opportunity and outcome. And here I appeal to work that's been done, I think, of not just Heckman, but also Alan Krueger, many people who are not economists. It turns out that the highest return is for preschool education. And I was thinking about the implication of taking preschool children who are way over at the left-hand tail of the readiness to learn distribution, and therefore are likely to be way at the left-hand tail of the productivity distribution when they get out of school, and moving them into the center of the distribution. This has two effects. One, it's obviously equalizing, but second, to the extent that moving mass from the left tail of a distribution into the center moves the center of gravity, moves the mean of the distribution to the right, this also, on average, makes the American labor force more productive and therefore promotes economic growth at the same time. Third, I think we should take seriously Borjas's findings about the skill bias in American immigration. Whatever one thinks about the numbers of immigrants, I think Borjas makes a convincing claim that there's no reason to have the negative skill bias that we currently have, thereby further eroding wages at the bottom end of the scale. Fourth, I think we should also take seriously the changes in corporate compensation practices. Lucian Bebchuk's paper recently showed that the share of compensation paid to the top five people at American corporations has exactly doubled just over the last 10 years. Why the top five? Because for a public corporation, you have to disclose compensation to the top five in your proxy statement. So it's easy to do. And moreover, this increase in the share paid to the top five is not just big in percentage terms, it's sufficiently large in absolute terms that had that increase in the share that goes to the top five people been spread over the entire wage distribution, the comparisons of top 10th over 50 and 50 over bottom would look very different. And without in any way saying that we need to or ought to interfere directly with corporate compensation practices, I think there are matters of corporate governance that we can and should address that would arrest that development and maybe even reverse it. So David, without in any way saying that we need to or ought to interfere directly with corporate compensation practices, I think there are matters of corporate governance that we can